I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. December starts the education politics season in Maryland and other states. That's when school districts begin to announce their budget proposals. And what the schools demand then feeds into the budgets of local jurisdictions and states. In Maryland, 4 years ago, the state passed a new law called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future, which sought to change public K-12 education by having the state pick up a greater part of the education spending burden and by prescribing improvements in five specific areas: early childhood education, high quality and diverse teachers, college and career readiness, compensatory resources for poorer communities, and a new governance mechanism. New spending to support the law has been authorized through 2026. But the state Spending Affordability Committee has received reports that spending will far outstrip revenue growth in the state. Maryland is in structural deficit. Now what? To get a lowdown on the blueprint's progress and prospects, I called one of the biggest boosters of the law, the Maryland State Education Association, the state's teachers union, where Paul Lemley is president and Nikki Woodward is vice president. If you want to know where your public schools are headed, stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersluis on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutro and Juniper.
Won't pick up my phone if it rings all night. Ask me anything, it's all right. I'll tell you I'm neutral. Oh, I'm really, really neutral, yeah.
Paul Lemley, Nikki Woodward, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thanks for having us.
Are you confident that the blueprint will be fully funded?
It seems to us like our policymakers, from the General Assembly to the governor, are understandably allergic to talking about taxes. And so I'm a government teacher. That drives me nuts. If we're being honest with our constituents, our students, you have to talk about both sides of that coin, taxes and services. Do you hate taxes? That's fine. But do you also hate public schools? Do you also hate the police? We need them to be braver, because they haven't been, during an election, understandably, super brave about saying the blueprint is expensive and worth it.
So what I'm hearing from you is a solid push for new taxes in the coming session.
Yes, is the short answer. If blueprint funding is in question, then absolutely raise taxes.
I think it's also important to elevate a local need for commitment. You know, one of the things I can't name for you all of them, but there were quite a few counties who came in with fund balances who then still chose not to fund public education. And so one of the detriments to the blueprint is that it doesn't put any real teeth or meat on the expectations on those locals to ensure that they're doing their part to fund the blueprint.
Nikki, name names.
I think I have one. I think Queen Anne's County is an example. Furloughing employees right now as we speak.
I was at the Maryland Association of Counties meeting conference over the summer this year, and the room, it seemed divided. So in particular, for example, from Montgomery County, Mark Elrich was there, and he was like, oh, yes, taxes. And on the other hand, there was a council member from Worcester County, and he was, no, we can't do that. We don't have the resources. We all agree that the blueprint is important, but we need the flexibility to make choices with respect to investments that you are asking us to make.
There's a specific timeline that the blueprint says that in which different components are supposed to be implemented. Locals do not have the option to say, we're going to wait 18 months to do that. They are going to have to answer to the AIB when that accountability is there for when things aren't put in place. So I think what we're going to see is cutting of corners in other spaces in order to meet the bare minimum to say they've met that requirement.
Where are you most afraid that these corners will be cut?
Class size. That's kind of the response of many counties, including Montgomery and Howard. These are affluent places. I work in Howard and Nikki in Montgomery. I want them to say, hey, we think this is more important than that. Or we feel like we can do this in, you know, an environment where we haven't addressed the teacher shortage.
All right, let's actually drill down then. Pillar by pillar, early childhood education. Where are we with that?
State board presented in September. There was a presentation on early childhood in which they went through and talked about the number and percentages of partnership. Wooster is the county that has 79% of their children are served by the county. Whereas you have a Carroll County where only 12% of their students are served by the county. The state is challenged by the private public partnerships. They are continually task forcing and working to build those out. Having had individual conversations with individuals in both Prince George's and Montgomery who serve on their collaborative work group that meets monthly, that talks through and it has members from all the stakeholders. And they really are struggling to be able to expand the partnerships in the way in which the timeline had outlined in the blueprint. They thought it would be able to be done.
Is it your belief that the legislature might increase the amount of money MSDE can pay private providers for those tier one, tier two families, or on behalf of those tier one, tier two families? Do you think that will increase now, or are they looking for other kinds of solutions?
We heard nothing around any changes of in which the amounts yet. When it comes to any substantial changes, it's mostly been around timeline.
Is MSEA as a body more willing to accept timeline flexibility in early childhood education as a result of that?
Some of these timelines are already reasonable. Like the licensure for pre-K teachers doesn't really come on until 28.
And that's okay. Something that needs to be lifted, right? That's additional questions that need to be posed to MSDE. What are the characteristics? What are the mechanisms that we're seeing that have created more sustainability? Is it in-home versus childcare centers? Are there parochial versus non-parochial?
Let's move to something that is even closer to your heart, which is high quality and diverse teachers, which is the second pillar.
Our colleges of education are starting to have higher enrollment. Teacher pay is up about 15% over the last 5 years, which I will point out does not keep up with inflation. While the starting salary starts officially in 26, most counties are there. Also, our counties had to negotiate. This is a part of the law that directs them to bargain the career ladder. And we're seeing some more people get their national board certifications to advance on that career ladder.
Paul and I both came into education on the alternative pathway. We didn't go to undergrad and become educators. We both were well on our way into exploring other careers and chose to become educators. And what we're seeing in the numbers actually is that more educators of color come into the field through alternative pathways than the traditional university. And so how are we putting in place the opportunities and the supports to ensure that our conditionally certified or our alternative pathway educators have what they need to be successful?
There's an overlooked function of the National Board of Certification here that a teacher who may come in conditionally or through an alternative pathway, they can get their National Board Certification and they don't need to do a master's degree anymore. That's a big difference in time.
And money.
I was going to add that. The National Board Certification is functionally free. You have to pay for your registration. And after that, your county provides the scholarship for the components, the tuition. And it's not free in time. But relative to a master's degree program, it's much less time, much less money. Get more conditionally certified teachers certified. And I think this was something that I'm not positive I'm going to get it right, but I think half of all our hires in the previous year in Anne Arundel County are conditionally certified.
We have to remember that the PAR system as a part of the career ladder is not a funded, there's no funding stream through the blueprint. So this is a part of the system that local education agencies, our local school systems, are going to have to figure out how to be creative and support that. The plus to it is that as a state agency, as a state union, we've been working to create and work with locals and be a soundboard to provide them support as they're developing and building those programs now.
All right, let's talk about the third pillar, which is college and career readiness. There are considerable questions about credits and standards and testing and
what's an industry certification?
Please tell me.
Well, it's something that we hope our students get, like 40-45% of them. This was the first area of the blueprint that I saw in action from the classroom vantage point. A whole bunch of counselors, deployed. And the way it looked, these are our college career ready counselors. And we had something like 325 kids in Maryland schools to every one counsel. And I'm sure that wasn't equal across every school system. We want something like 40% of our students, I think it's 45, to obtain some kind of certification towards a trade, towards a field. Where are we in this? And I know we're deploying some of the people to get them there, but I don't really know what that means yet for students other than I'm starting to see them do it.
Yeah, so that would have been my first question, but since you already pre-answered, let me ask you, what is the basis of saying 45%?
No, historically, I don't know, Nikki.
It's totally, I mean, I don't, so this whole pillar, I read about standards and I read about measures and I read about this and that, and I'm like, where are they getting all of that? You know, we are talking about trade schools. There are not enough seats. There's also a much deeper problem, right? If you're going to say 45% of kids should have, some kind of vocational training, fine. But some of these kids are taking 10 APs. They are all bound culturally, at least, even if not academically. If that is the aspirational side of this thing, particularly in Howard, Montgomery County, I would say Prince George's, right? If that is where, you know, that's where parents and families and students aspire, and we are saying, oh, now, please, 45% of you have to have vocational training, you're going to get frustration if you try to push them in that direction when they're saying, no, take Calc BC or differential equations.
Yeah, I can, as a high school teacher, I really saw it firsthand a lot. But it didn't seem to me to be a problem. I had students that I would have expected to be only focused on college, trying to pick up that early credential in nursing. I think it sort of goes together, right? If you're an EMT first, You get into the nursing school you want better. I think the actual problem was the same problem we've always had, in that students with resources saw options and students without resources didn't see any options. When I first started teaching, Howard had a requirement that you had to pass Algebra 2 to get in one of the career academies. So it's a barrier. So I still think our problem is finding options for kids who aren't as able and don't have the all the supports and can't drive to work.
But determining that ability is tricky.
That is.
You know, it almost sounds like tracking at that point. And you don't want to be that suggestive, especially to a poor black kid. Here is your auto repair mechanic thing. Don't try for Harvard.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. That's still our problem, too.
The other big, big issue is the fourth pillar, which is more resources for certain students. You know, there is various formalizing about compensatory aid. And tell me what's going on there. What should we know?
Well, we know Maryland is the fastest growing place of community schools.
Describe to me how community schools are really different from other schools, because I don't understand the difference.
What happens in a community school is that it's more than just, a lot of people say, services. That is one entity in which it's done. One thing we know, that when our children show up to our schools and any part of their needs are not met, we know the impact it has on academics. So unlike our Title I schools that potentially offer opportunities of meals, breakfast, and lunch, our community schools think about what happens before you get there and all the time that you're not there. So one resource is ensuring that there are, especially in our communities where there are food deserts, ensuring that a lot of times there's many of our schools that they offer a food pantry so that families have the opportunity to come and have nutritious opportunities. That also includes, many of our schools work with the University of Maryland's nutrition science program, in which they are providing healthy opportunities and understanding and knowledge for families around that. We have connections with everything from health opportunities, from soccer teams to language programs for our families and our children to be able to access. It also provides that opportunity of collaboratively planning across and thinking about the wellness of a student throughout the day. What are the things that students need? And when they're having moments of what some may call a behavioral challenge, for them to be able to have that timeout moment, the independent timeout moment of thinking through, making better choices so that they are able to get back into the academic, that it doesn't disrupt them, that they are not able to access their academic, the academic learning instruction that's happening.
Is it your contention that all of that does not happen in a regular school?
I know it doesn't happen in a regular school. There are not many schools that aren't community schools, that have an actual food pantry that serve 4,000 to 5,000 community members in there, or have a laundromat so that families can sign up to come in and wash their clothes. I mean, just the, I don't want to come to school because I know that my clothes aren't washed. The attendance changes we've seen. I could speak specifically to Georgian Forest. We worked so hard to make sure that they had a washing center. Now they have a center that families sign up for, and that they can come in on other weekends before and after school to be able to ensure that their students and their families' needs are being met, and that they're not taking 3-4 buses to go take care of that. They can be spending time with their children doing the other things that most other parents would love to be doing that enrich their children's lives.
It's an anti-poverty initiative, of course. And we don't always think of it that way, but I think about it as, we want outcomes for kids who are poor to go toward and achieve the outcomes for kids who are not. And locating the services that they need in their school is not new, like you said. But if we're really trying to have a kid, and this is where I don't think we'll spend a lot of time talking about test scores, but what we're really seeking is outcomes for students that are more equal. And to do that, you have to almost make a kid not poor. And that's what a community school tries to do.
I think it also welcomes families in a different way that we've seen to be real partners in inviting and welcoming into the school. When you're a parent who potentially has to work more than one job to meet the needs of your family, or you're caring for your, you know, many of us live in what we call the sandwich area, right? Where we're taking care of not only our own children, but we're taking care of our elder, you know, our aging parents. And so when you have those additional demands on your family, they have an consequential impact on it. And so what we know and what we've seen for our families who are a part of the community schools is that it's the having that those resources, those specialists, those professionals, the community wraparound support and stakeholders involved is an equalizer.
I really appreciate this idea of being more welcoming, because it's very hard for a parent to get into a school, like literally physically in a school, and because of security concerns, this and that. And so it is kind of extraordinary, just that step. But I think the expectation was that we would get these local school councils. Has that happened? And how do they work?
Every local school system, it should be two parts to that. There should be a county level that oversees all of those. And there should also be the site levels. And so what I'm hearing is that that first year that you're identified, that is a part of that needs assessment process. You are digging deep into the community to determine where are your assets, where are your needs, and who are the people who would be of support. And so I'm finding that when the schools individually are doing really deep engagement around those needs assessment and needs and asset assessment about that community, they are naturally finding those members, parents, students, educators, and core community programs and entities, that they're able to find those councils and implement those by the end of their first year.
Do you want to speak a little bit about the compensatory aid? There's a kind of concentration of poverty idea that is, you know, zip code based. And there was this issue that, you know, if you have a concentration of poverty at 65%, you know, and you get this huge largesse, but if you are at 55%, then you are basically out of luck. Or you get a very small amount, and that's really, that small amount may or may not be worth the extra burdens that are placed. Those are the kinds of complaints I've heard from various school districts.
Well, I think there's often confusion of when the fundings come into play, right? Versus being in your first year where your school really is compensated for your coordinator and your health provider. And that health provider varies, right? It can be a nurse for some school. If you're Kennedy High School and you already had a health center and you became a community school, you invested that in more behavioral health support. The compensatory, that doesn't come into until later in the play of it. And right now, you have to remember, we're only in our fourth year of actual real implementation, because this happened during COVID. Let's just be honest. That 2021 was a challenge. We also, MSDE, did not have in place a leadership in that office at all. They had someone for not quite a year, and now they have an amazing person and Derek Anderson, who is really leading this and really meeting this. And so I think that any growing pains that were felt during that time around that part of it were real because of COVID impacts of MSCE's, you know, inability at that time to identify the right leadership for the program. And so I think the folks give us another year. I know Derek's been working hard to help people understand how those funds are can move and should be moved and rotated over to another year sometimes if you're finding that you were able to meet your demands and without spending all of it, that doesn't have to mean that it stops, that it can rotate into another year and it could be utilized to uplift academic, instructional, and additional resources.
Well, that brings us to, I think, the final pillar, which is the accountability part of it, the governance part of it, because, you know, there was a failure at MSD with the Accountability Implementation Board and the Maryland State Department of Education did not work together or had difficulty working together. Are their work now integrated or the systems are still separate? I can tell. What is going on the governance side?
The AIB still has plenary authority. We already alluded to the AIB's ability to change timelines. I guess the most direct response I can give you, our sense of the governance is that it's still a little bit unresolved, that there are people on the State Board of Education side who don't really understand the need for the AIB. And there's people on the AIB who say, hey, State Board, you couldn't possibly do the work of the AIB in addition to the work of the State Board. I think that they both have an important role. And I do subscribe to the feeling, if you want to call it that, that we really couldn't implement the blueprint meaningfully without the AIB.
And I think they're working well. I don't know if you saw, I believe it was in August, maybe it was August, that they did a joint meeting where it was the State Board and the AIB came together and had a public meeting to be able to really tackle, talk through, and offer support. And I think the more that they can continue to meet and also work together and have a joint space around the discussion, the better it is for everyone.
Nikki Woodward, Paul Lemley, thank you for joining I Hate Politics. I hope MSEA will make available its Blueprint Bootcamp to the community.
You want to see a meeting that no one comes to?
You'd be surprised.
You know, as I've gone through it, I'll confess a little dread on the front end, right? 7 2-hour sessions on the blueprint. But I've loved it.
Please come back. We love to talk education and I Hate Politics.
Appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you.
What lessons can we draw from my conversation with Maryland State Education Association President Paul Lemley and Vice President Nikki Woodward? The blueprint for Maryland's future is in some trouble. Based on current projections, the state is unlikely to be able to fund the blueprint if one of two things don't happen. The economy miraculously improves, or there is a new tax that brings in new revenue to match the gap. The governor and the state Senate leadership have been resistant to new taxes, but the House of Delegates has said that they are willing to consider one. Given the standoff, unless things change dramatically, it is likely there will not be a big new tax to match the gap before the governor's re-election year. The good news is 2026 is also the year when the blueprint's current funding runs out and the big decisions can be put off until 2027. In the meantime, we will likely see extensions to the blueprint's implementation timelines across all the pillars that need money. That is all except the governance pillar. The pillar with the biggest movement has been the one about teachers. Most counties have upped salaries for teachers and have created new career ladders. National board certification has picked up speed and conditional licensure is growing. The expansion of early childhood education continues to be slow, and the internal contradictions in college and career readiness pillars remain unresolved. The pillar likely to lag the most is compensatory assistance for high levels of poverty. which involve big cash transfers, and benchmarking there can be controversial. While all of this is true, it is worth taking a step back and to think about the big picture. Why public education? What does it take to have good public education as opposed to good private education? While we think of these two things as replacement, they are not, in fact, the same. Private education is a private good. Public education is a public good, non-excludable, that is open to every child who lives in a jurisdiction. And ideally, even non-rival, that is, one child's education does not adversely affect the education of another. Indeed, public education adds public value by bringing together different classes, ethnicities, races, and others. At its grandest, it is the defense of democracy. Private education will lay claim to these values, but they are under no obligation to educate all children. We have also long known that family wealth is the best predictor of educational outcome for children in both private and public settings. The challenge in a public school is whether government spending can fill the resource gap faced by children from poor families. While it is relatively easy for governments to match funding, actual education outcomes in public schools still vary based on family wealth. The blueprint was based on the idea that it takes more than money. The pillars in the blueprint for Maryland's future, I talked about with Paul Lemley and Nikki Woodward, were intended to combine with increased money to produce better educational outcomes. Will they? To be honest, it is hard to tell. One of the big problems with public spending for any common purpose, as opposed to private spending, is that performance measurement is extraordinarily difficult. Imagine this. The Defense Department isn't even fully audited. Moreover, education is co-produced by schools, teachers, students, and families working together to make improvements. If things don't work, we cannot, as much as we would like to, isolate responsibility cleanly. This is why we often measure performance in the public sector with input variables rather than output. Budget spending, hours worked, people reached. What also ends up happening then is that the most resourceful element, usually the government, steps into wherever there is a breach. Community schools building a laundry room, schools providing breakfast and lunch for students, Chromebooks for home use. There are hundreds of examples. While public education benefits from economies of scale, its problems of performance measurements are forever. Except some low-cost Catholic schools, private schools in Maryland not only charge more than what public schools spend per pupil, but they can also remove the failing student or the one that requires more resources. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band, Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time.